the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
Hello, Trauma Hounds. It's the Chris Keeper here. And yeah, I know I don't sound exactly enthused this month. You see, we're doing all John Carpenter's movies, so that means, we're gonna do a couple movies that aren't exactly gourmet bloodbaths, if you know what I mean, and this month it's Starman, which isn't so much as a horror movie as it is an intergalactic love story. I mean, most movies have somebody who dies in it, and yes, one person dies in Starman, but they're brought back to life, so that cancels it out. And then another thing is brought back to life, so that makes the body count -1. But we're doing all of John Carpenter's movies, I guess, so we have to. Even though I don't see Memoirs of an Invisible Man on that list. Well, at least it's a consolation that we'll be back to the bloodbaths next time. Wait. No, I'm just hearing that next month we're doing another science fiction movie. I might as well just shoot myself now. Yeah, right. That doesn't work.
Hello and welcome back to this vault of startling monster horror tales of terror. I'm Chris Honeywell, and I'm here with my two co-hosts, Luke Giaconetti.
Hey, how you doing, folks?
And the hair metal hero.
Hey, guys.
And notice that I did you guys one at a time this time. I'm learning.
Yes.
And joining us, finally, for the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror is Scott Gardner.
Yay!
Hey, how's it going?
My co-host from many other Two True Freaks shows.
I am pleased and delighted to be here, although this does not make up for callously leaving me out of They Live, one of my favorite movies.
My roommate, who is a skilled in the art of knitting and beading and stuff like that, is making, you know, those little beaded purses that like old ladies have,
mm-hmm,
with really tiny beads. She's making Rowdy Roddy Piper with his sunglasses on from They Live as a beaded, it's like this, it's just as an art piece. It's just as a little square, probably 6x6 inch square of Rowdy Roddy Piper sort of pixelated. It's beautiful. She's obsessed with that movie.
I thought you were going to say she's obsessed with Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Maybe. I should ask her, but so, yeah, maybe. But, yeah, that aside, we'll put all that torrid, horrid past behind us and come to Starman, which is, this is an unusual one for the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror, because you know, it's on the border of what you would call horror. I don't know if you would I wouldn't call this movie a horror movie, but it is a John Carpenter movie.
Yeah, and we've watched Carpenter films that have kind of fallen outside of the bounds of horror before, you know.
Into action and...
Yeah, Escape from New York, Escape from L.A., Assault on Precinct 13, all clearly not horror films.
Big Trouble in Little China.
Yeah. They might have scary elements, but they were clearly action. This is a whole other animal altogether, because those films still had a lot of the kind of standard Carpenter touches, whereas this one is, my note here is a sweetness and light, which is really not what you expect when you say John Carpenter.
Yeah.
It is sweetness and light, but it's tempered with John Carpenter.
Yeah.
I'd sort of put it this way. It's definitely a toned down John Carpenter, but it still blows a little smoke in your face every once in a while. He made a point to say, "I'm John Carpenter. I'm blowing smoke in your face." Every once in a while, you know, it would poke through.
Well, it's also another one of his films that he didn't write. He didn't do the music for. And he's basically a director for hire on this one. And he had to do it because his career was pretty much over after The Thing bombed. So he kind of needed to do this.
But, you know, the thing is, to me, I can definitely say this is my favorite John Carpenter movie. But I think it's between this and The Thing, which are, like, his technically his best movies, you know, as far as cinema goes. And this, to me, this may be his best movie. From a technical viewpoint, from an acting viewpoint.
Yeah, I would definitely say from an acting standpoint, because really, when you look at Starman, you look at the story, this has the potential to be some really cheesy crap.
Yes.
You know? But then you get Jeff Bridges and Karen Allen, and their performances are so authentic and genuine that we forget about some of the really oddball stuff that is involved in the plot here, and we're just sucked into this character drama between these two people. And that gives the film a lot of credibility.
It's the mature version of E.T. is what it is.
Yes, it's E.T. where E.T. actually gets to do it with someone.
Well,
you know, it's really funny that you say that.
Touching, yeah.
It's very funny that you say that, because my wife came home when I was about 3/4 of the way through the movie, and at first she kind of was kind of rolling her eyes going, oh God, you know, I haven't seen this in, you know, 30 years, but she ended up, you know, watching the end of it with me, and we got to the end and I was like, I think that holds up really well. And she said, yeah, she goes, it's basically E.T. with sex, you know, which is pretty much what you just said, but
oh,
yeah.
Geez. That's the way I've always felt about it. It's if an alien species came to Earth and they could assume our form, and I don't know, it's just well, very mature and very sweet.
The minute he put food in his mouth, you knew he was going to have sex eventually, because he was just like, wrong! One thing, you know, one thing leads to another, and that was, it was all over. The moment, I want to say, what was it, Dutch apple pie?
Yeah.
Yeah, the minute the Dutch apple pie hit, that's like one of the most amazing scenes of acting I've ever seen.
Yeah, just, the restaurant scene is my favorite part of the entire movie, because I think the acting and you know, the scripting, the writing is very, very strong, but the acting in that part is just, it's that's the scene that sells the movie, because that's also the scene where the tone of the movie begins to change, where, you know, Karen Allen starts to come around to, you know, I like this guy and I need to help him. You know, up to that point, she's like, yeah, I got to get away.
I'm
you
going
know,
crazy and I got to get the hell out of here. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the, you know, that's the scene that changes the entire tone of the movie, to where, you know, he's not such a bad guy and I need to help him. You know, I like that a lot.
I rather liked the that bus stop restaurant. I took one look at that. And said, hey, this is a Chris Honeywell kind of joint right here, I think.
That's where we grew up.
Mm-hmm. It is very much.
I've lived out scenes like that with rednecks, you know, talking loudly over, you know, stuff like that. Yeah, I mean, but even that scene is so over the top. The redneck is so over the top. He's just got greasy, you know,
spitting
his tobacco.
I completely disagree, because, you know, he reminds me of every hillbilly that I ran into in my 18 years exile in Georgia, of going, what's the matter? Cry when you saw Bambi? Yeah, asshole, I did cry when I saw Bambi, you know?
I cried when the deer came back to life, so yeah fuck you,
exactly.
Redneck. I
cried when I saw Karen Allen's thighs at the beginning of the movie.
Hey, I tell you what, it's like a karma sort of thing, because we see Karen Allen in her underwear, and then like 5 minutes later we get full on of Jeff Bridges' butt. So it's like, oh, you like that, did you? Well, here's Jeff Bridges' ass.
Here's something for the ladies. But you know, it's funny that you guys are comparing it to E.T., because one of my notes is it starts out like a horror version of Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yes, yes.
Well, and the other one it always kind of reminded me of a little bit is Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes.
Yes.
Because, you know, what's the main The main gist of Day the Earth Stood Still is that extremely powerful alien comes to Earth and he's benevolent.
And we shoot at him.
Yeah, we shoot at him and we're scared of him. Same kind of idea here. You know, we've got Sherman, at least, is not aggressive towards him. Sherman's actually a really good character also. But, you know, that's it. It takes a lot of these sort of 50s sci-fi cinematic tropes and kind of spins them on its ear. And what's interesting is that it starts out with a shot of Voyager 2, and then we move into, you know, the Reagan-era Cold War. And, you know, now the response is not, oh, we put out this message because we want to find intelligent life and be friendly. Now it's like, well, we got something coming in. We better shoot it down.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that was a very John Carpenter moment, is V'ger boogieing along to Satisfaction.
Yep. Gotta love the Stones there.
Believe it or not, I ran out and bought the 45 to that after seeing this movie.
I remember that.
I did, and I played the hell out of it, too.
45, those are like big CDs, right?
Yeah, basically.
Jesus. Come on, we're not that young, Luke.
I know. I had a record player as a kid, too. I gotta make the joke. I'm nothing if not an obvious prankster.
I think you guys had a great point about, you know, the fact that basically this movie is better, much, much better than it actually deserves to be, because it has incredible potential for cheesiness, because by the time this movie came out, E.T. had been imitated and you know, just ripped off, you know, across the board, from things like, you know, Mac and Me and, you know, just all these other cheesy. So, you know, this movie really had, as you say, you know, a lot of potential to just be, you know, nothing but goofy and cliched, but it really does work. I think it's sold very well.
Well, the whole Jesus thing could have been really corny.
In my opinion, that's the only truly original thing that this movie brings to the table is, you know, the whole, you know, alien comes down and he's nice, he's sweet, he needs to get back home had been done to death by this point. You know, not just E.T., but all these other things, you know, and you know, as Luke pointed out, the parallels to some of the other movies. So really the Star Child thing is only, you know, the only truly original part of the story, you know, in my opinion. So yeah, that alone wouldn't have been enough to sell it, I don't think. I think it was just that, you know, it's directed in such a different way from the other movies that basically tackled the same subject matter. Don't you think?
Because, you know, the only real trope for, you know, the Star Child, as you refer to it, it would be something like, you know, the Mysterians or Mars Needs Women, where, you know, they're going to come and forcibly impregnate our women.
Right,
and that's
right. Just right. Sort of a cheesy idea of like, we need women, come gather up the pretty women. Yes. Well, I like this because it's not, if this was a modern movie, and this is one of my little things I hate about modern movies and like started getting big with The Matrix, was the whole idea of chosen ones and this person being hinged on fate and stuff. And really, the Starman did not come here to plant a seed on Earth.
No.
He came down here just to say, hi, what's up, and then go back and check up on us. And then he got caught up in it and happened to have a kid. I like that it wasn't like a preordained, you know. But
that wasn't his mission, yeah.
Right, it wasn't his mission. It was just something that happened off of it. And I wonder if he got like bitched out for canoodling with the natives when he got home, you know. when Orkin got him and was just like, what are you doing?
Well, there's a lot of elements of this film I think you couldn't do in a modern film that you could get away with back then. For one thing, let's face facts. The Starman would have been black. I think we all can agree on that. Probably played by Will Smith if they had remade this film nowadays. He would have started dancing at one point. He would have been listening to hip-hop.
Oh, yeah. Somebody would have been like, here, let's, you know, there would have been, yeah. Boom. I feel good.
And you can imagine it going rolling downhill from there.
They'll turn on the TV and he'll be like dancing along to Ellen or something like that.
You know, but here, in one of the things that, and I've got a couple of notes of this, one of the things that Carpenter sprinkles through here, Scott, you mentioned the stones before, is that there's a lot of just really, you know, really from the heartland Americana in this film too, which I love. And that's a Carpenter trait.
Yeah.
You know, is that that Americana stuff?
Well, it's a road movie in America. You know, heading down the.
Well, I mean, you know, they're driving in the Mustang. You know, we get the, you know, all the music, all the travelogue aspect is such a great, you know, little travel film, a road show film of America, and
right.
It's like, you know, he didn't land in, you know, Europe. We've got to show him in context of America, and I really enjoyed that aspect of the film. I've come to really enjoy well done travelogues. I've been watching a lot of Cinerama films, and those are mostly travelogues, so I've kind of had it on the brain a little bit. I also love the when they're in the motel. What's he watching on television? He's watching From Here to Eternity.
Right.
More classic American.
Yeah, just about as a classic a black and white movie as you can watch a American movie, exactly.
And as far as a romantic film, also. You know,
and a lot of the food he eats. Well, I noticed they were very...
cobbler and, you know.
Well, they were very careful not to give him any meat. He didn't eat any meat. Like, I was wondering about that when they were in the diner. I'm like, I seem to remember that he got a cheeseburger, but it's Karen Allen that got the bacon cheeseburger.
Yeah.
You know, and he got eggs. I think he got eggs and pancakes and stuff. But yeah. They made sure that, you know, that he was vegetarian. You see, I only have one problem with this movie. I would have edited one thing out of this movie, and it was at the very beginning when he was doing his little float outside and transmitting a message home, and you had the subtitles there. I would have taken that scene right out.
Mm-hmm.
I would have taken it right out because at that point you realize, okay, he's, you know, you get his mission and you get that he's probably nonviolent and friendly. And I would have cut that out and left the viewer more in Karen Allen's shoes up until the point when he pulls a gun on her, you know. I would have left it more of a horror movie up until that point of where you're like, is this guy kidnapping her? You know, what's going on? And, that's just a minor quibble.
And that's something, you know, that a studio suit would have balked at.
Right, right.
Oh, you can't leave that. The audience is going to get lost.
It explains too much, and we don't want them to worry too much about these characters.
I tell you that first scene with Karen Allen in the cabin, where we go from the POV shot to the scenes, the effects shots of the Starman growing, to the turnaround reveal. That's just, I mean, we've watched a lot of John Carpenter films here, and I think for like a 8-minute sequence, that may be the single best directed sequence we've seen, because that's just, there's no dialogue in it. It's all just visual, and it conveys so much in that. And the effects work, the camera work is dead on. The whole thing, the entire mise-en-scene comes together right there for that.
Well, really, that whole beginning sequence is just a very cinematic way of telling a story, except for those subtitles. You know,
right.
you just have, you have Voyager, you know, you just through visual means, you see it, and, you know, through stuff you see in here, you see him read Voyager, head to Earth, you find out that Karen Allen's husband is dead for some reason, or, you know, somebody that she loved is dead and she's in mourning, and it's all done without any, you know, any kind of dialogue or exposition or anything like that.
Right.
I love movies like that, and a good part of this movie is like that.
Sure, it would be a retcon and everything, but I would really, really like there to be, you know, like a special edition of this, adding just one line, and it's where she walks in to the living room there, and the baby is on the floor, you know, and it's like its head is glowing and everything, and it turns over, and it's that little bug-eyed baby. I'd really like to hear it say, "Quaid, start the reactor." Because it totally looks like that. What was that guy's name? Quatu or whatever from Total Recall.
Wow. I thought I had a bad reference here when I wrote that, you know, when they're handling the golden disc, all I could think of, it's like, oh, it's like the golden disc that Megatron has in Beast Wars. But, you know, because, well, just that actually is the same disc, but that's a long story I won't get into here. So.
Now, another reason I really like this movie is it has two strong connections with Star Trek: The Motion Picture. One of my favorite movies is not only does it have it starts out with a Voyager probe, but also the novelization to this was written by Alan Dean Foster, and I have that somewhere in my collection. I read it when the movie was new, and I remember it having some extra scenes in it and such, but now for the life of me, I can't remember what they were. I remember it fleshed out his character just a little bit more, because you get into his head, you know, a bit more than you do in the actual. Actually, I don't think you really get in his head much at all in the movie, come to think of it.
No, it's pretty much all from her point of view.
Right.
Yeah.
I remember it being a really solid read, though. I just wish I could remember it better, but this is going back. God, this movie is creeping up on 30 years old. So.
I know.
Now, you said we went to see this together?
At least once. I saw this movie a bunch of times.
Where did we see it together?
This at the the two cinema multiplex, because I remember it. This is how I remember it was you and me. We walked from my mother's to there. And we had to walk over that bridge, and was that sign for Benny's Steakhouse?
That's right.
And we took all the letters. This. We stole all the letters off the Benny's Steakhouse sign. We went to see Starman, and at certain points of the movie, we would fling letters at the screen for some reason, and it was amusing as hell to us.
Did one of them stick in like Jeff Bridges' face or something?
It's the corner of it stuck in the screen for like a good 10 seconds and then dropped. Yes, that was you. That was one of your shots. That was a good shot.
Well, didn't we climb up on the marquee? We changed Starman to R-Man up on there.
Yes, I thought we did. Yes, so we have a vast history of Starman. I even remember watching the Siskel and Ebert review of it. I even remember them talking about how Jeff Bridges studied birds, you know, the movements of birds and the way they cock their heads and stuff to put into his performance. And he studied marionettes and moved himself like a marionette a lot of times, and like a combination of a marionette and a bird, which I think was a good combination.
Well, he did something right. He got nominated for Best Actor for it.
He should have. Jeff Bridges should be held. I think because he's been in so many pop movies, he doesn't.
Bridges, he's one of those guys where he's just beloved. Everybody likes Jeff Bridges, you know, for some role or another that he's played. Everybody likes him, whether it was, you know, the dude or Obadiah Stane or the guy from King Kong, whatever. Everybody likes him. So when he finally got his Oscar, it was kind of that, you know, lifetime makeup call, you know? It's like, hey, dude, we're doing you a solid. Thanks for all the years that you toiled without us giving you any awards, you know?
Now, Chris, do you remember the very next year we went and saw the next Jeff Bridges movie that I remember us both having the same reaction, which we felt like he was still channeling Starman in the next performance, which was The Jagged Edge with him and Glenn Close. You remember that?
Yes, that was a good movie too.
That is a good movie. I like that one a lot. I was thinking about that today. I was like, I wonder how long, you know, how far that was in the future. And it was like the very next summer. But I remember us both having that reaction that we felt like he was still in Starman mode in that movie, you know.
That was one of the, I think that movie, like, your parents took us to see that one.
I think so. Yeah, I think you're right.
Because that was like, because your parents always took us to see the normal movies like that or Witness or, but they would always take us to see the movies that had at least like one of our science fiction stars in it.
Right.
So we would at least go without kicking and screaming. I think for both of those movies, we kind of kicked and screamed on the way to the movie, and then we're like, that was a pretty good movie when it all was said and done.
I remember my mother regretting taking us to Witness, because they took us to Witness, because I remember my aunt was visiting and she lived in Pennsylvania, and she found out the movie had something to do with the Amish, so she thought, oh, this would be a nice whole Kelly, what's her face?
Oh,
there.
That's right. That was those were,
Kelly McGillis. Yeah.
I love moments like that in the movie theater when you're like, because with Scott's mom, okay, I like Scott. I've always liked your mom, but I never liked your mom when the TV was on because she never let us see the boobies. We'd be watching Kentucky Fried Movie, and his mom would poke. They'd be playing cards in the other room or whatever, and she'd poke her head and be like, "What do you want?" She had like psychic, you know, premonition of boobs coming up. She'd be like, what are you watching? Change the channel. And we'd have to change the channel. But in the movie theater, you're trapped. There's nothing you can do. And then when the boobs come out, there's nothing you can do. It's there's no going back. And we'd be just like, yes, score. Yes. Of course, there's points taken
away. I'm still like that.
There's points taken away because you're watching them with parents around and you can't really revel in it as much as you'd like to. But it's still...
Say what you wanted to say. You didn't want to say revel in it. You wanted to say touch yourself. You can do it. This is an adult show.
No, that was only in the case of what was that David Bowie movie with the vampires and the lesbian scene?
Oh, shit.
What? Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, hero. Yeah,
that was the one with Susan Sarandon. Yes. And, what the fuck is the name of that movie? It's not Vampire's Kiss.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
David Bowie was a vampire in it, and
I only remember him from Labyrinth and what was it, The Man That Fell to Earth or whatever. That's all I can remember.
I've never seen The Man Who Fell to Earth. I've heard it's really 60s cheesy style.
Yeah, I remember it coming on HBO, and I watched like
the
five
Hunger.
Minutes of it.
That's it.
It was The Hunger.
He's in that?
Yes. Or not The Hunger. What? Yeah, it was The Hunger. And yes, at one point he ages, like, you know, he to like 170 years old. And but he's got his wife, girlfriend, is bringing Susan Sarandon into the fold. And there's a long lesbian scene with boobies and touching and the... licking and the bloodletting, ladies. And I was watching the movie with my mom, and it was a very arty movie.
Yeah.
And it was a very arty scene, but it was nice and raunchy, and it was just, and you know, my sister and my mom were watching it, and my mom's going, well, this is a pretty good movie. Oh, gee. Oh, no. Well, I can't stop. Well, maybe the scene will end soon. No, it's not ending.
Is this at the theater?
No, this was on TV.
Why didn't she just change the channel? That's what my mother would do. All right, well, we're going to watch.
We were already, it would have been an uproar because
700
we were three
Club
quarter of the way through the movie. Yeah, I don't think they were playing the 700 Club at 11 o'clock on HBO and Saturday night.
I didn't care about having my eyes covered for the boobies, but like watching Predator or something, it's like, no, I want to see all the gory action.
Yeah. Right.
See, when I've told this story before, but somewhere around my 7th birthday, my dad took my brother, my mom, and I to see a double feature of Predator with the sneak preview of RoboCop.
Ooh.
Coolest dad ever.
That pretty much shaped my entire life when it came to cinema right there. I had the RoboCop one sheet on my door for like basically until I got the Darkman one sheet to go on my door. And it, you know,
is that the one where he's getting out of the cop car?
Yes.
Part man.
Yeah,
part
I have
machine.
That somewhere too. Yeah.
I don't think people realize how
fell in love with that.
Unless you saw RoboCop when it first came out, just how innovative the pure violence of that movie was.
Yeah. Well,
always struck me about that is, like I said, I saw the movie, I was either 6 or 7. I don't remember if it was before or after my birthday because they both came out summer of 87. And, you know, when you're a kid, you watch RoboCop and it's so cartoonish in the violence that you take it in stride. It's not till you get older that you realize, holy crap.
They're
really
just taking that person's body apart, yeah.
Yeah. You're a kid, you're like, you look at it like a comic book, you know? So you're just like, that's awesome, he's a cyborg now.
Well, as you get older, you get injured more, so you start maybe feeling those bullet wounds a little bit more.
On my Criterion DVD, they put the scene back in with the Ed 209 just shooting the corpse.
Right, it's like 30 seconds long, too. Guy just keeps getting pummeled.
I love it. I love it. But anyway, you know what else I love?
Starman?
Starman. Yeah, that's
that movie.
You know what scene actually always cracks me up every time? He tells Karen Allen where he's got to go, and she has no idea where to go because, like, she's an American, so geography of her own country is an absolute mystery to her.
Yes.
It's like, I guess that's Colorado.
He's just like, yeah, you know where here is? We go here. And he's pointing to that spot on the map, and I'm like, no American's going to be able to navigate to that point on the map like that.
West and hope for the best. Mm-hmm.
And here's another thing that was I noticed that I've never noticed before. This movie even had a scientist in a wheelchair. The classic for alien UFO movies. And he's just in that one scene, and he's an old, you know, the classic, and it doesn't come off as being cheesy, or I probably would have remembered it. And another thing I noticed, this movie doesn't have the usual tough guy protagonist.
No. Because our protagonists are the Starman and then Sherman. Mm-hmm. And he's a wormy guy, you know. Although he is a smoker, at least.
Yes, and he does get to blow smoke in someone's face. He does the classic Carpenter, you know, Snake Plissken thing of, you know, he's just sitting down to his nachos in his football game and light his cigar, and they call him, and he just seems always ready to light his cigar.
Yeah.
And never gets called away. So the one chance he gets to light his cigar, it's when he's screwed over the people who are going to put Jeff Bridges' brain on a scale, which you could tell, like, he noticed the straps on the table. The first thing I noticed was the scale, and I'm like, oh, there's a scale to weigh the brain and the liver.
I always love a good cinematic slob, and first scene with Sherman, you know, that's a good cinematic slob.
Oh, right? Yeah, he's got grease all over his fingers, and he's, like, licking his fingers clean and stuff, yeah.
And you gotta keep eating before we answer the phone, you know?
I was especially proud of myself that as I was watching this, it gets to the crater scene, and you've got all those Black Army helicopters flying all over the place. There was one quick cut. Actually, I think they show him a couple of times, but it was just a couple just quick little cuts of one of the pilots. And I didn't really think that I knew what John Carpenter looked like, but for some reason I kept seeing that pilot thinking, I think that's John Carpenter. And then I was, just before we got started, I was looking at a list, his filmography, that actually listed where he appears in his own films, you know, very Hitchcockian. And sure enough, that was him as the helicopter pilot. So I was very proud of myself
That's funny, because I thought I spotted him as one of the rednecks. I thought he was one of the rednecks, and then I was looking for his name in the credits, and I never saw it in any of the acting credits. So I'm like, oh, he must not have been a man. You got good eyes. I did not that at all.
Yeah, I didn't pick up on that either.
Well, I thought that was funny that you guys had mentioned that that you didn't think you were going to do. What is it? Memoirs of an Invisible Man, because according to the same thing I was looking at, he was his cameo in that one was that he was a helicopter pilot too in that movie.
He must be taking helicopter lessons or something. Right. Like, I might as well kill two birds with one stone.
I tell you, the casting I love in this movie is Richard Jekyll. I love seeing Richard Jekyll. Anytime you can get a cast member from the Green Slime in a film like this, I'm always on board.
Now, who did he play?
He was Fox. He's the government agent.
Okay. He's the heavy.
Yeah. And what's funny about Fox as a character is that when we first get introduced to him and he's interacting with Sherman, he raises some legitimate questions. He's like, you know, if this kind of person has this kind of technology, you know, how do we, you know, we have to be careful with how we deal with them and all that. And that was pretty interesting, because normally, you know, a heavy in this sort of film is just a war hawk.
Yeah, it's usually chewing the scenery.
Right. He very quickly devolves into that as we get on with the film. But I like that they at least gave him some basis of rational thought here as to why they're taking the steps they are, because really, you know, we've been trained that to believe that aliens are either going to be incredibly benevolent or they're going to be like from, you know, Independence Day. So it's probably going to fall on one end or the other. You don't want to be caught thinking it's one when it's the other, you know. So,
well, it'd be really funny as if it turned out to be they're just slobs, you know. Like,
I'm really hoping that when the day comes, that the more I think about this, the more I really hope that they're like the Pakleds, you know, where they're just like, you know, our ship is broke, we need it to go, you know, that sort of thing, you know, where they're dumber than us, yeah, so that we don't have to worry about it very much.
Have you guys ever seen the film Morons from Outer Space?
No.
No.
Morons from Outer Space is a British comedy from the early 80s, and that is basically the premise, that these three aliens land on Earth, and they have nothing to offer. You know, they don't really know how their ship works. They're just three regular people, and they become super celebrities anyway. But, you know.
Yeah, it would be like Joe Sixpack in King Arthur's Court or whatever, yeah. that's gonna be like a Larry the Cable Guy movie now, you know, like
that's from Outer Space,
Virginia Redneck in King Arthur's Court.
Yep,
you're done.
That's probably already been done, come to think of it.
Yeah, probably.
But yeah, it probably, if it hasn't, it'll be done eventually.
Well, I can tell you, all that makes me think of is South by Southwest. I don't know if they do this every year. They did this in the year that Grindhouse was released. They did a contest where you could make the fake trailers.
Uh-huh. I remember
movies.
That.
And there were some absolutely great ones. And if you go on YouTube and do like SWSX or
Hobo
SX.
With a Shotgun was Hobo made shotgun. Because of that. One. Hobo with a Shotgun started out as an entry in that.
Right, I think it won.
Yeah, I think it did too.
But there was one of them that, but like I said, if you go on YouTube and do a search, you can find everybody's entries for them. And there was one that Scott, your comment made me think of. It was called Black Renaissance, and it's about it's a blaxploitation movie where the Shaft like lead character gets thrown back to the and he's running shooting down guys in collars. Black Renaissance.
Did it have like a scene where he was teaching people to dance and like be fun, like a bunch of knights to be funky or something like that?
No, it probably would have if it actually been made.
If it gotten made, yes.
He found himself in a different time.
Excuse me, brother. Do you know I can get back to 110th Street?
Maestro Da Vinci did not send you back in time to seduce my daughter.
Man. I ain't down with the cut of your genius.
Now in the 16th century, he continues his war on the man.
Morris Devil, prepare to meet thy death. Eli Hawkins!
Harlem Renaissance.
Now, do any of you guys have this movie on DVD?
I do.
I do not.
Does it have any bonus stuff on it?
No, not a goddamn thing.
That sucks, man.
Like most of Carpenter's movies, it's basically, yeah, bare it's John bones. Carpenter.
Yeah, bare bones release.
I mean, do you think this movie's been kind of forgotten today?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, the only reason I even heard about this film growing up was that in the early days of the Sci-Fi Channel, the Starman TV series was one of their shows that they
Scott
would air.
Scott and I were talking about that.
Yeah, we were, yeah. I was wondering if we were going to bring that up in this or not.
Well, it's got Ted Stryker from Airplanes, about the only remarkable aspect of it that I'll talk about.
Ted Stryker.
Do you know him, sir?
Never heard of him. That's not exactly true. We were like brothers. We flew together during the war.
Well, I just found out that the kid that played his son in that show went on to be Spider-Man on the 90s Spider-Man show.
Yeah, you know, Greg Brady from the Brady movies.
Oh, is that who it is?
Yep. Christopher Daniel Barnes.
Yeah. Okay.
And Robert Hayes, you know, played Iron Man in the Iron Man cartoon.
That's right. And then Jeff Bridges went on to play Iron Man's nemesis in the Iron Man movie. So, yeah, there's Marvel Comics connections all over the place there. That's pretty wild.
I don't know why this movie is forgotten. It had critical success. It did good at the box office. You know, it had Oscar nominations. I mean, it really should be.
Oh, did it? What was it nominated for?
Wasn't it Bridges Best Actor?
Yeah, Jeff Bridges was nominated for Best Actor.
Who won that year?
I have no
idea.
I probably don't want to know, because it'll probably be one of those instances where, you know, somebody from like Annie Hall or something won, and it'll just piss me off all over
again. It definitely
again.
Wasn't Annie Hall that year.
No, yeah. I know. You know what I mean, though. Yeah, but I asked because, you know, now that we've seen Bridges revisit, you know, one of his other classic characters with Kevin Flynn, I mean, you know, as I say, you know, this movie's creeping up on 30 years old. I wonder if possibly this movie could be revisited, you know, and we see the star child, you know, as an adult, and maybe even I don't think you could really bring Bridges back.
It wouldn't make sense to bring Bridges
back. It wouldn't
back,
yeah, it wouldn't it, it would be
well,
really
well they
awkward.
Could bring well they would but just Karen have to bring Allen him back could, as computer generated again. He would just have to do
yeah.
a Tron.
The the winner of Best Actor in 1984 was F. Murray Abraham for Amadeus.
Never seen no. it.
I like that movie. I thought that movie.
Yeah, I like Amadeus also. That was weird.
Really
that was
movie.
Because that's one of the few times that I can think of where two actors from the same film were both nominated for Best Actor, because Tom Hulce was also up for Best Actor, also from Amadeus. So.
Okay. I remember watching that when it came out, like on video as a kid, just like, oh, I'll check it out, and ending it. It ended up being like one of the most inspiring movies, like. About art and about how artists are, you know, like how genius and stuff. Yeah, whatever. Were there any boobs in it?
I was just going to say that I remember the trailers, and I remember thinking, I'm pretty sure this movie's not going to have tits, car crashes, or explosions,
yeah,
so
but,
I don't think
Mozart,
I care to see it.
Mozart was a cooze hound, man. He got into it a lot.
Yeah, but, you know, I'm sorry, but, you know, this movie here, although it's a little lacking on the movie factor, that, you know, it does have the prerequisite number of explosions and car crashes for me. So,
oh,
you know,
yeah, it has a gas tanker explosion. It. So,
yeah.
There
you go.
Yeah.
It's, you know, what's interesting is that, talking about that explosion, I don't, and this maybe it's just because most of the music in this film isn't very Carpenter-esque, but in the build up to that scene to the explosion, the music gets very Escape from New York.
Yes, it does.
Yes, I noticed that too. Yeah,
I was gonna say the music isn't very John Carpenter. It was funny because I saw Jack Nitzsche did the music, and Jack Nitzsche's, you know, he's done a lot of soundtrack. He did the soundtrack to one of my favorite movies, Never Give an Inch, but he's known as like a rock producer, like for a lot of stuff. And I was like, huh, so they're probably having Jack Nitzsche in here because he's going to do a more cinematic, something that John Carpenter couldn't do. But his score was very synthy and stripped down. And John Carpenter could have, he probably doesn't write music like that, but it was well within John Carpenter's style to have actually probably done that soundtrack. So I found that very interesting. I thought it was going to be really far away from John Carpenter, and it wasn't really, except the music was a little more beauty music, you know. It had that sort of synthesized angelic sound to it, especially, you know, once, you know, any kind of, you know, Starman thing would happen. But it still had a sort of minor key edge to it that still made it sound sort of dark and Carpenter-y. I think that's what the whole what worked for the whole movie is John Carpenter put the edge of like a little bit of dark edge to it, and a little bit of his gritty, you know, action when it was needed, when it came up, you know, and his feel for, you know, his feel for settings like a truck stop and stuff like that, and the sound of like the gravel under people's feet and stuff. He really, when you're standing out in that parking lot in any parking lot at night in there, it felt like a parking lot at night, you know. It had that feel of it, not like a lit set or anything. And
well, this movie has a really unique feel because it, I think it really straddles the line between your quintessential big budget summer movie and kind of a low budget, you know, John Carpenter movie, you know, a typical John Carpenter movie, because there's elements of it where it feels like the big budget effects movie. And then there's other elements of it where it almost felt
it's a
like
car chase. Yeah.
You know, there were several scenes like with the helicopters or, you know, panning across some, you know, some field or something where I got kind of almost like a Dawn of the Dead vibe off of it. But, you know, mm-hmm. that low budget feel. And I mm-hmm. like that. It's a very unique feel for the movie. Plus, this is what I would really classify, even, you know, explosions and everything, I would still qualify this as a quiet movie, if you know what I mean. It's not big and flashy and bombastic. It's kind of quiet in the way it tells the story and the message that it sends. And I like that. I think that's really cool.
The real big moments of this movie are all emotional moments. The big things that happen in it are all really between him and Karen Allen. They're not the explosions and him going home and stuff. Those are just the propelling the story. You know, the big thing is her coming to terms with her husband's death and, you know, finally being able to have a baby and him finding out what it's like to, you know, what his race is lost through being non-corporeal and all that.
With the tanker explosion, the important thing's not the explosion, it's him carrying her out of it.
Yes, yes.
And the note that I have that, you know, you mentioned him going home, the very last scene in the film. The note I have is, what is important? Carpenter shows us what's important. What's important there is not the ship and not the ship pulling off into the sky and the atmosphere. No, what's important is Jenny. And so the camera stays on her and we see her reaction to it.
Yes.
And
right.
The varied emotions that she feels there, and that's what's important. And that's what, again, why I alluded to earlier that this is not a film we could make today, because today that would have to be the big money shot of the big mothership pulling him up and leaving, and then we'd cut back to her. It's like, no, what's important here is not that he's, you know, that he's leaving. It's what's important is how she has changed because of this experience.
Right.
And it's emphasis on character that makes this film really stand out from a lot of its contemporaries and a lot of the films that came after it too.
Mm-hmm. Well, plus one thing I really like is that it's an intelligent science fiction movie in the fact that it doesn't have to hand you every answer. I mean, there's a lot of really nice moments of the movie where you just kind of have to go along with the ride and you have to infer a lot of what happens. It doesn't come right out and tell you that the little ball bearings are, you know, a different superpower, you know, each time he uses it. You just pick that up. And one of my favorite scenes of the whole movie is right at the end when he's looking almost like a zombie. You can tell he's physically just
degrading. Out of steam,
And as soon as the little red beam comes down from the ship, he perks right up. And nothing's, you know, it's never commented on. There's never a moment where he goes, ah, you know, I feel the power again. Or anything like, you know, anything cheesy like that. It's just a little acting thing that he does where he just perks right up. And I like that. You know, I like when, you know, they, you know, the people
they
behind
treat you like you're intelligent,
like I have a brain and can, you know, I can pick this up myself. I don't need you to explain it to me. You know, that's great.
Yep.
That's really a nice moment.
And that's something, Scott, that we've seen again and again in this series that we've done watching Carpenter's films, because John Carpenter may be a lot of things, but he doesn't treat his audience like they're morons.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He doesn't dumb down what he's presenting so that it can be consumed easier.
Well, if what he's presenting looks dumb, like Big Trouble in Little China, then all you have to do, when you start looking into it, all of a sudden it starts becoming really smart, too. So there's always a lot of intelligence.
And that's, he works well in different genres. You know, a lot of guys get pigeonholed into doing one thing, and, you know, Carpenter's known as a horror guy, but we've seen his breath allows him to do different genres, and it's the approach. The approach is always the same.
I know we're still going to be pining for that Carpenter Western forever, I'm afraid. That would be so awesome. Like one thing he does in this movie that I really noticed it was different, and another thing that was sort of underplayed is every time it's a road movie and eventually you pass through Las Vegas or you end up with a scene of Las Vegas. And what's the first thing you usually get? Ba-da-ba, you know, signs and lights and the filmmaker taking advantage of having the visual sumptuousness of Las Vegas.
He doesn't do that.
He makes it look ugly at first, you know, to the Starman, Las Vegas is all these lights and flashing stuff. But to, you know, in the world that he comes from, in the world that we're sort of living in now, Las Vegas is kind of dirty and, you know, you see it from the outskirts and it's like kind of dingy and drab. And the one scene in Las Vegas is sort of like the camera's in close. You know, there you see the casinos behind him, but you don't see the large buildings and stuff. So he really just tones down the whole, and you know, and Karen Allen at that point is just sort of like, yeah, we're in Las Vegas, whatever, you know. And I love that. That, you know, most filmmakers would not have been able to pass up the temptation to have him, you know. Yeah, like nowadays they would have him, you know, in a hot tub. You know, they would be like, come on, let's get a hotel room and relax and, like, gambling and, you know, at the... Yeah, it would...
Yeah, as I said, it can't... This kind of film can't be made again. So please don't try. go find an original script and make that.
If there's going to be a Starman 2, John Carpenter better be involved. That's...
If there's going to be a Starman 2... What it needs to be is it has to be the Starman having a dance-off to save the youth center from being destroyed.
Ooh, I like that.
Electric boogaloo and just, you know, just eliminate any pretenses right there.
Oh, my God.
I mean, ultimately, I don't think I want him to touch this movie at all, but if it came down to Starman 2 versus, 2012 Starman, I think I'd rather get the sequel than the remake, if you know what I mean.
And you know, mentioned Flynn before. I mean, really, you could do a Starman story kind of in the same vein as Tron Legacy.
Right.
That, you know, we have the sun already planted, you know, right, literally and figuratively. So you could sort of that sort of story, and it would be at least a logical conclusion or a logical turn of events.
What a poor choice of words.
Totally intentional choice of words, my friend.
Well, now that I think of it, didn't she say, you know, you're not, didn't she say something like, are you coming back? And he's like, no, I can't come back, or I'm not.
Which was the reason I never bought the TV show. I remember watching through, I think, maybe the first two commercial breaks of the pilot episode and just going, okay, this sucks. And I never watched another second of it. But that was the line I always remembered from this movie, was she asked him point blank, you know, I'll never see you again, will I? And he says no. So to have him just come right back again in the beginning of the TV show was like, oh, wait a minute.
You see her again. They eventually track her down in the TV show, too.
Yeah.
See, I would have done it more like if I did from what I hear, I never saw the TV show. But what I would have probably done was like the Sarah Connor Chronicles with her, with her son, raising her son, and maybe what was his name, the actor Paula Matt, who you know, with that character, with the SETI character, maybe as their protector from, you know, the government forces or whatever.
Yeah, it's because Starman show was a lot like the Incredible Hulk.
Yes.
Basically, the Starman and the Star Kid were going from town to town. In this case, they were looking for Jenny, and Agent Fox was on their tail every week. And so it was a lot like, Mr. Yeah. McGee and all that.
Right.
I was just going to say, that's Agent Fox, don't make me angry.
That's where I felt like the show made its mistake, is that I completely agree. It should have been Jenny and the son, doing whatever, you know, on the run or, you know, whatever adventures they were doing. You know, rather than it being the alien coming back, that was the part of it that just never made any sense to me. But this, you know, the story of the child still intrigues me to this day.
Well, he's teen Jesus. He would be like teen Jesus,
right? Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. Well, you know, I would love to. You know, I'm really disappointed that there's not, you know, to my knowledge anyway, there's not some you know, special disc out there, you know, or something, you know, full of, you know, interviews with the actors and the, you know, the director and all that, because I would like to know the scene where, you know, it's all revealed that, you know, he's given her a baby and, you know, what the baby's going to grow up to be and all that is in the desert, you know, when they're in the back of that truck and there's the Indian woman in the scene, you know, and you see like the whatever, the Arizona or whatever in the background, you know, and it just got me to thinking that, you know, that isn't that very much part of the culture of those people, that, you know, that that's kind of their religion, right? That they believe that, that they, you know, they come from the stars and, you know, the whole thing of star children and the star people and that sort of thing. So I almost wondered if there
he was definitely,
you know, something intentional in, yes, that scene. You
oh,
know?
I think he was definitely, you know, just from John Carpenter's point of view, you know, that comes through in his movies. He definitely was like, here, you know, the American, you know, the American Indian family, the Native American family, just take him right in, you know, they take him right in. She's talking, you know, and it's not like, say it was a Mexican family that maybe didn't speak English, that, you know, they could speak English, and, you know, so Jeff Bridges and her are talking freely. You know, they're not even like, you know, pretending that they're talking freely in front of these people. So they're portrayed as being pure and trustworthy and, you know, in touch with, you know, I mean, if you would think maybe Carpenter was thinking they're more, you know, they can sense that Jeff Bridges is, you know, a pure and awesome being or whatever. But there was definitely an element of that. And plus, it was all superimposed with, you know, beautiful nature. And another reason why that scene is another reason why Carpenter should do a Western. I would love to see how his Western looks with, you know, sweeping backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
And you know what's funny? If Carpenter ever does make this Western, it's going to star Jeff Bridges, Kurt Russell, James Woods.
You know? Oh my God!
Just Alice Cooper, just straight down the line.
Roddy Piper.
Roddy Piper. Yeah. the meaty guy from Prince of Darkness. You know,
Pam Grier. Yeah.
Pam Grier. Yeah. Just Ice Cube. It'd just be the greatest.
It'll be awesome. Yeah.
Jehen Stretch. Just be the greatest on one movie. And they would basically be just the band of killers, basically. You know. And then it would just be Rio Bravo again, and they'd be the gang that was under siege. And
he should just do Rio Bravo.
Yeah,
nobody's remade Rio Bravo in a long time, right? Yeah. Right? Not as such, anyway. He's used to it. He's except for him, he's remade it a bunch of times, but never formally.
Yeah.
No, see, you know what would happen though? Again, the studios would come in and they'd say, "Okay, Ricky Nelson was in the original. Who do we get that's like Ricky Nelson? Bieber. We'd be fucked."
Yeah, but maybe,
maybe they'd get like what Ricky Nelson's son, who is in the band Nelson.
Okay, yeah, we're gonna put Gunner in there. He's only like 50 now.
I like that name. I used to know a kid named Gunner.
Okay.
And it's also a good horror name because it's the name of Leatherface.
That's it.
Yeah.
But is it if it's Gunner with an A, you can get away with it. If it's Gunner with an E, then you belong in the Dreadnoks, you know. So
I saw an alarming name today. I was walking to the store and I noticed one of my neighbor's car has a big, you know, one of those big jacked up pickup trucks, and it's on the license plate, it says Hoagie. I was just like, there's no way that this is a skinny guy driving this truck.
Well, come on, that was Michael Caine's name in Jaws 4.
Was it? Oh, well.
I think so. You see, everybody wants to forget that movie.
The hair metal hero, Jaws 4 super fan.
Oh, God, no.
You should read his fanfic sometimes, guys. Yeah. Go to Jaws4fanfic.com, sub Chris Tyler, and check out all his his Jaws 4.
Yeah, the shark doesn't eat anymore. He fucks everything.
Oh.
What, you can't do slash fic for Jaws? Come on.
why you couldn't. You can do slash fic for anything else.
Why not? Yeah.
Media masochist showed us that. So
yeah,
unfortunately,
burned into my brain because of that. Yeah. As a matter of fact, it couldn't be worse than anything else I've ever read.
You read it. You can't unread it.
Me, I would do the Jaws 3D.
Yes.
Oh yeah, by the way, I finally caught Piranha 3D.
Awesome.
Did you? Is it as booby filled as they say?
God. Holy shit. There is tits everywhere.
Really? You don't say.
It's 85 minutes of tits and ridiculous death scenes, and that's it.
It's fun for the whole family.
Yes.
Assuming the family is like Hero and you live by yourself.
And it's funny. It's a French director, too. That's the funny thing. Doing, like, bringing back American exploitation with blood and boobs. Like,
it has one of the greatest death scenes I've seen in the past 15 years.
So that means I got to go find the Joe Bob Briggs review of this movie. I'm assuming Joe Bob Briggs still does movie reviews, because remember he used to rate his movies on beasts, breasts, and blood.
Yep.
And it sounds like this has all three in spades, and it sounds like he probably would have busted a blood vessel in his head when this one came out. I really regret not seeing it in the movies in 3D because I hear they use the 3D with all the blood and the ridiculous effects and the boobs. And
actually, if you want a good laugh, go to the IMDb page for Piranha 3D and then read the section where they have a content advisory feature on IMDb. read the content advisory page for this, where they try to objectively describe all of the gore and sex.
Right.
It's a freaking laugh riot trying to hear. And then the piranha bites this and bites that.
Yeah, so they try to quantify it for the parents. And
yes.
It's like, with movies like that, at a certain point, it's like, why quantify it? Why not just say, look, don't have your kids watch it. You know, if you're a religious fanatic, don't have your kids watch it. If you're super liberal, don't have your kids watch it. You're going to hate it no matter what. Don't do it. There's blood and boobs. And that's all you have to say. But of course, everybody wants to see. Well, I must know exactly how many boobs they were and how large they were.
73 boobs. Figure that one out.
Yeah, my kid is. I only let my kid see B cups and below. You know,
yeah.
So
anything else is indecent.
It's just too much for him. So, you know, give him a couple years before he's watching any Russ Meyer.
And you know what's absolutely amazing? The film we're actually talking about, all we see is Karen Allen in her underwear.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was nice, though.
I don't think Karen Allen was one of the actors. I think she never did nude. Did she do a nude scene in Animal House? I don't think she did. Did she with Donald Sutherland?
She did that, and I think she's got one more somewhere down the line. Pretty sure she's shown everything.
Yeah, I think this movie was probably PG, so I think they were probably trying to stick to it. It might have been PG-13.
No, I think it was PG, actually.
Because the sex scene was all basically one shot, you know? It was one medium close-up from the shoulders up sort of shot that they just sort of faded in and out of. So you could tell there was probably nothing more to it.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that I feel like I would be remiss if I didn't apologize somewhat to Karen Allen, because I remember in one of our older episodes, it was probably when we talked about
Crystal Skull
at some point. We totally forgot about this movie. I think we said she was in Raiders and then pretty much was never in anything again until, you know, Crystal Skull, which, you know, obviously is not the case. She was in this, which was a huge hit, you know. This was a big deal.
Of what
and then
I've
it was
seen of her, this is her best acting, too.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. I think she looks her best in this one, too, because I never found Karen Allen particularly attractive appearance-wise. I mean, she's attractive in that, you know, she's got spunk kind of way.
She's the spunky girl next door.
Spunky girl next door, yeah, but she's actually attractive in this movie, too, you know, physically attractive, I think, in kind of a slightly tomboyish way, but, you know, Because that last scene that we fade out on at the end of the movie, I was like, you know, she's actually really pretty in that part. So
she was probably feeling pretty good about herself because she was like getting to get up every morning and make out with Jeff Bridges.
The high pro glow, is that what you're saying?
There are dog foods that may have extra protein, but only High Pro helps give your dog that high pro glow.
Healthy High Pro Glow Energy Improved High Pro.
You improved High Pro. Now it's even more digestible with no fillers to give your dog more usable protein on the inside for more of that high pro glow on the outside.
Healthy High Pro Glow Energy Improved High Pro.
Try new improved Purina High Pro.
No, but I like that. I forgot about you in the hypro glow. Oh, man, what is it with dog food commercials? I just saw the Chuck Wagon commercial for the first time in a long time, and I'm like, you know, that's probably my favorite commercial of all time.
I love the Chuck Wagon.
The Chuck Wagon commercial, for some reason, when I was a kid, would make me run just like the dog to the TV to watch the Chuck Wagon commercial. It was fascinating.
It's pretty cruel, though. It's kind of like people that, you know, use the laser pointer to, you know, to tease the dog.
To tantalize the dog and catch
it. Oh, no, there's nothing funnier than that.
Are you kidding me? If I had a dog, you know I'm an animal lover, and if I had a dog and I had a remote control Chuck... Now there's a $1 million idea, making a remote control Chuck Wagon wagon. but it would have to be able to go into, because it would pass through the wall like a ghost into the... And I love it, and they open up the counter underneath the sink where the dog food is kept right next to like the Drano. There's like a big thing of Drano sitting there, and...
I just want to see the one where the dog's chasing the Chuck Wagon and the Chuck Wagon pulls that fade into the counter, you know, into the cabinet door, and the dog just plows into it head first. You know?
Or where the kid comes down and finds a dog chewing on a dying little cowboy that's like,
kill me.
No, he's got the cowboys fending the dog off with like a toothpick, like in The Incredible Shrinking Man.
Yeah, you know? The dog's chewing on him and the cowboy's just like, hey, partner. Finish me off. I can't feel my legs.
Now I just have to ask, you guys know that I don't listen to this show because you bastard me out of They Live, but
hey,
all of your episodes
thanks for the plug, man.
Like this?
What's that?
Are all of your episodes just completely off the rails like this?
No, yes. Our episodes are usually so well ordered and oh man, they're razor tight every time.
We never tangents where we have to use that exact same segue that I used earlier.
What, you know what a good movie is? Blank.
Yeah.
Actually, I've got a rough draft of the Vault of Startling Horror Monster Tales of Terror drinking game. And,
oh, Jesus Christ.
Anytime someone says, you know what is a good movie? You know?
I think one drink will be when the hair metal hero goes, oh, Jesus Christ. Also.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy is another one. Drink again, baby.
We'd all be dead.
Yeah.
5 minutes in.
You'll be dead.
And every time I introduce the two of you at the same time and, like, you both say hi at this over each other, that should be two drinks.
Oh, boy. But where do we even go from here? I know where we go from here. What movie are we watching?
What are we watching next time?
Next time we are going to be watching Dark Star. We're staying as science fiction, but we're going about 180 degrees away from Starman.
And about... time. $30 million less in budget.
What's funny is I used to tour with the Grateful Dead, so Dark Star was like all the most wasted deadheads would be in the audience yelling, Dark Star! Dark Star! And it's funny, and I've always associated Dark Star with John Carpenter's first movie.
Yeah.
And instead of the Grateful Dead is in. Although I'm sure I will put some Grateful Dead music in the next one just to be a bastard. I'm looking forward to. I love that movie. That you talk about movies on a shoestring. This is going to be a fun one.
And yeah. I haven't seen Dark Star in a number of years, so it's going to be fun to watch this one again.
Yeah, that's going to lead to some interesting conversations, just in terms of what it was the model for.
And bad beach ball jokes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now, actually, for our listeners who are interested, I'm checking this right now, but I'm pretty sure if you go to AMCTV.com, that's AMC's website, I believe they have the entire film of Dark Star up for free streaming.
Ooh. So
their B-movies section. Let me see if this is still going to work here. I'm loading it right now. I found this a couple of... actually, it was last year at this point. I found it, and it's like, oh, I got to keep this in mind. Remember to mention this if we when we get to the show. So, I'm pretty sure it's also on streaming on Netflix if you want to go that route as well.
Now it's making me... It's this whole thing of, like, fresh out of film school project made into a movie makes me want to do THX 1138, too, at some point. I always associate THX 1138 and Dark Star.
Yeah, I can see that.
And, yeah.
It looks like it's on there. So, we've got AMC TV... /B-movies, you can find Dark Star to watch.
And see the origins of John Carpenter, although I hear there's a rumor that it's going to show up that it's been bouncing around that certain people have gotten a hold of a copy of one of John Carpenter's student projects, I believe at USC, that was basically his early prototype for Halloween. So I'm hoping that's going to show up on one of the, like, YouTube or Vimeo sites soon enough. It was one of those things where Carpenter, I guess, found it and was just like, here, pass it around. So it's bound to show up somewhere. So that would be really cool to see. Yeah. If I can find it before we do the next show, maybe we can do a little sidebar about that. In it too. Or maybe we'll do a sidebar on that when we do Halloween.
Yeah,
but,
nice.
All right, well, thanks for showing up, Scott.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it. I truly love this movie. It had been years since I'd seen it, and it was really fun to revisit it. And it's always fun hanging out with you clowns, so thank you.
And you would have killed me if...
Yes, there's that part, too.
Two of them in a row.
Yeah.
All right, we'll see you next time. Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy. And there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN. You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com. Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners. You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled S-C-O-T-T-G-A-R-D-N-E-R. You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me. Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details. Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up. We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league. If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
That picture of Liberace. Oh my God.